Harper. Tabitha must be really desperate if, as Ainsley said, she approved of Harper staying with Ainsley for the summer. So Harper packs up just what she will need for the season. Clothes, shoes, toiletries, books, computer, one good kitchen knife, her food processor, her cast iron skillet, leashes, chew toys, rawhides. What else? She is nearly 40 years old, but she has acquired very little in the way of material things. Will she need her surf casting pole or her mountain bike? Doubtful. Fish follows Harper around as she tucks things in boxes. Go lie down, Harper says, pointing to his Orvis bed. But he won't. I'm not going to leave you behind, Harper says, and she kisses his snout and rubs his back, his mostly black fur silvered now. She throws away everything in the fridge and most of what's in the cabinets. What should she do with Billy's ashes? She wonders. She doesn't want to leave them here, in the nearly empty duplex, but taking them off the vineyard feels wrong as well. She decides to take them over to Billy's house, where she places the urn on his mantle. Billy's clothes she'll donate, but later. When? When she comes back? Yes, she decides. She will come back in a few weeks, a month or two, by the end of the summer. For now, she takes Billy's invoices and accounts payable file. She can work on his paperwork while Ainsley is at school this week. Before she leaves the house, she snaps a bunch of pictures. Every room and the yard, so she has them for posterity. She has decided to sell the house as a teardown, which pains her. As bad as it might have been, it was Billy's. But the idea of a gut renovation, finding talented, available, reasonably priced people to hire, then managing them, is simply not an option. Harper has been fired. She has no income. She doesn't have the money to pay for a renovation. Billy has around 90 grand in his savings account, but according to Polly Childs, it will cost nearly double that to do the work required. Harper will have to sell the house as is, pay off Billy's mortgage, and split the difference with Tabitha. That part can't be avoided. Harper had taken Billy to his lawyer in Edgartown, and they went over the terms of the will. Everything was to be split down the middle with Tabitha. Mrs. Tobias had served as a witness. If they sell the house as is, they will each walk with 100 grand, maybe a little more. Would it be nice to sell it for 1 million and get triple that amount? Sure. But she's not up for the challenge. Harper wants to see Reed, but she can't call him and she can't text him. She cannot walk into the hospital to confront him in person, which is what she has wanted to do since he left the reception. But Harper does drive through the hospital parking lot. Reed's Lexus is there. It looks the same. Nothing about it announces a major upheaval in his life. What is it like for him at home now? Harper imagines the air is crackling with things unsaid. How has he explained the affair to Sadie? Has he said it was a mistake? A lapse in judgment? Has he blamed Harper? Called her a vixen? A temptress? Has he told Sadie he loves Harper? Has he admitted to being torn and confused? And what has he said to Greeny? Reed isn't a demonstrative man. He is serious and discreet. He is a doctor. Being caught like this, talked about, discussed as the object of gossip and rumors, must be soul-shredding for him. Harper blames the whole affair on the Morning Glory farm market. In the weeks preceding the visit to the farm, Harper had logged in a lot of hours at the hospital with Billy, back when his problems were treatable. Dr. Zimmer had been the man in charge of Billy's medical care. He explained what was going on with Billy's kidneys, his liver, and his heart. He went over the medications in meticulous detail with Harper. Also, he talked to her about Billy's diet and exercise, what he was allowed to do and what he wasn't. It was all very professional. Only once had he laid a hand on Harper's arm and said, "He's lucky to have a daughter like you." Harper had responded, "He's been an excellent father to me my entire life. I'm the lucky one." When Harper bumped into Dr. Zimmer at the counter at the Morning Glory Farm Market, she had recognized him but couldn't place him. He was wearing a tight, colorful biking outfit and a helmet and wraparound sunglasses. Harper was standing at the counter where she was about to order a Morning Glory muffin fresh out of the oven. The market was engulfed in the aroma of cinnamon, raisins, orange zest, and toasted pecans. "Harper," Dr. Zimmer had said. He smiled at her, and Harper thought, "Wait a minute, who is this guy?" Then, an instant later, she figured it out. "Dr. Zimmer!" She checked out his spandex. He looked like he was wearing the flag of Uganda. "I didn't know you biked." Dr. Zimmer nodded at his Fuji, leaning up against a tree. "Stress-relieving hobby," he said. "Do you have time for a cup of coffee? My treat?" "Sure," Harper said. "Thank you." She rarely hung around the Morning Glory because there was too great a chance she would bump into Jude or Jude's partner, Stella, or someone who worked for Jude. And sadly, Harper didn't have friends she could meet at the farm for coffee and a muffin. She occasionally brought Fish with her for companionship, but Fish always attracted attention because he was so darn good-looking, and attention was precisely what Harper wanted to avoid. To sit with Dr. Zimmer was a good thing, though, she thought. Dr. Zimmer was a revered member of the community, and he would lend Harper respectability by association. They had sat at the picnic tables under the oaks for the better part of an hour. They started out talking about Billy. Harper confessed that Billy was still smoking one cigarette a day, despite the fatwa on tobacco. Then they wandered off topic, experimentally at first. Dr. Zimmer had said, "Do you have siblings? Other family?" Harper sipped her pumpkin-flavored coffee. This was the first time it had been available since the previous fall. It was a natural question to ask, she supposed, but it put the pleasantness of the encounter at risk. "I have an identical twin, actually. She and my mother live on Nantucket." Dr. Zimmer had slapped a hand down on the green-painted wood of the picnic table. Like most doctors, he had beautiful hands. He didn't wear a ring, but Harper knew he was married to the woman who owned the pie shop in Vineyard Haven. She had, at least, done that much research. An identical twin on Nantucket? Harper pulled off a chunk of muffin, then opened one of her three foil-wrapped pats of butter. Normally, Harper dragged the muffin through the butter, making a mess of the butter and her fingers. But that day, in the polite company of Dr. Zimmer, Harper had used a plastic knife. The muffin was already rich and moist, and adding butter was like dipping jelly beans in icing. "You wouldn't be able to tell us apart." "Come on." "I'm serious. We look exactly alike. The teachers at our school never figured it out. Neither did our camp counselors or our friends. Our own parents. Lots of other people." "And she lives on Nantucket with your mother. That's crazy, right? You and your father live here, and your identical twin and your mother live on the other island?" "Crazy," Harper said in agreement. "Are you close?" "No," Harper said. "Our parents' divorce drove a wedge between us. Then my sister and I had a pretty serious falling out 14 years ago now." "That's too bad," Dr. Zimmer said. Harper shrugged. "I talk to my mother periodically, although she's tough. Her name is Eleanor Roxy Frost. Have you ever heard of her?" "No," Reed said. "Should I have?" "I guess not," Harper said. "She designs dresses. She's a pretty big deal in the fashion world, or she used to be." "You're single, right?" Dr. Zimmer asked. "Are you dating anyone?" Again, Harper shrugged. "I date here and there. I've never been married, no kids." "Do you have kids?" "No, no kids," Dr. Zimmer said. "I want them. My wife doesn't. And to be fair, when we got married, I didn't want them either. Apparently, changing one's mind about wanting children isn't allowed." He let his voice drift off. "What do you do for work?" He was changing the subject. No kids with Mrs. Zimmer was a sore spot. Harper smiled. He obviously hadn't heard about her involvement with Joey Bowen. I deliver packages for Rooster Express. The next time Harper saw Dr. Zimmer, they were back at the hospital. It was late evening, and Billy had been urinating blood. Dr. Zimmer had him admitted and told Harper she could go home for the night. He was leaving the hospital as well, and he had walked her to her car. It had been the quintessential autumn night, cool but not yet cold, the air smelling of wood smoke and leaves. "Would you like to get a drink?" Dr. Zimmer asked. They went to the brick cellar at Atria, a place Harper liked, but where she would never go alone. Reed ordered a glass of wine, and Harper followed suit, although she preferred a beer and a shot. Reed, as soon as they got out of their respective cars to go inside, he had insisted Harper call him Reed instead of Dr. Zimmer, said he was hungry, and since Harper could always eat, they ordered a grilled Caesar salad, the lobster tacos, and the peach blueberry cobbler, and shared everything. When Harper groaned over the cobbler, which was a rather orgasmic groan because the cobbler was so good, Reed turned to her and said, "You know that's arousing, right?" That had been the start of things, Harper supposed. Her inadvertent food groan elicited Reed's choice of the word arousing, which automatically gave their new friendship a sexual edge. It had been Reed who had ventured there first, not Harper. They each had another glass of wine, then a glass of some persimmon cordial that the bartender pressed on them. She had received a complimentary bottle from her wine rep and was anxious to be rid of it. And the next thing Harper knew, she and Dr. Zimmer were kissing like teenagers in the back seat of his Lexus. The details were hazy, but Harper knows that she did not invite herself into his car, so he must have enticed her. It went on like that. Clandestine meetings whenever Reed worked late. They would meet by the East Chop Beach Club or in the back parking lot of the ice rink. And then, in the spring, Reed finally agreed it would be safer to meet at her duplex. 3 weeks ago, when Harper told Reed she was going on a date with Sergeant Andrew Truman of the EPD. "You know him, right?" Reed had left the hospital to meet her at her duplex in the middle of the day. He was jealous, he said. He knew it was unfair, but he didn't want Harper to start dating Drew. She had laughed. "You can't ask me to do that," she said. "You can't ask me to do anything. You're married." Harper stares at the Lexus a few seconds longer. It's a black car, baking in the sun. "Goodbye, Reed," she thinks. Her stomach is hollow and sour. She wants to leave him a note or a sign, a heart drawn in the yellow pollen on his back window. But she can't. She pulls out of the parking lot and considers driving by the upper crust to see if it's open, if Sadie is there. Harper would just as soon believe that Sadie is back at work as that she has hung a sign on the door that reads, "Closed, husband cheated on me." Harper is afraid to drive by the shop. She's afraid that Sadie will see her. She's afraid to drive around the island. She could bump into Dee, Billy's nurse, who sold Harper and Reed out, or she could bump into Franklin Phelps, Sadie's brother, whom Harper had always counted as a friendly acquaintance. She loved going to hear Franklin sing at the Ritz. Now she can't show her face in the audience again. She could bump into Drew or Chief Oberg or one of the Snyder sisters, all of whom would know by now that Harper is a faithless catastrophe. But Harper has to drive through Edgartown, right down Main Street, in fact, to get to the Chappie Ferry. There's simply no way around it. Before this week, Harper had loved Edgartown. There are certainly things to love about the rest of Martha's Vineyard, the low stone walls, the farms, the cliffs of Aquinnah, the wild beauty of Great Rock Bight, the gritty fishiness of Menemsha, the Methodist campground and tabernacle in Oak Bluffs. But Edgartown is still the crown jewel of the vineyard, in Harper's mind. Or maybe that's just because of a snobby aesthetic preference she inherited from Eleanor. Edgartown is like Nantucket. It has an architectural integrity, and an elegance that Harper finds powerful. The old Wailing Church and the Daniel Fisher House are like the grandparents of town, old, white, and stately. Harper loves all the clapboard homes with the voluptuous window boxes on North Water Street. Main Street has the best shopping and the restaurants with the most delicious food. Edgartown has the prettiest harbor front and the most picturesque lighthouse. Edgartown would be a fine place for Eleanor to open a boutique. Harper had long thought this and even suggested it once, but her mother had merely laughed. "Not on Billy's Island," she'd said. "That would be the last place I'd pick." Harper lines up for the Chappie Ferry. She has to say goodbye to Brendan, not only for her own peace of mind, but also because she can't stand to think of him wondering why she's disappeared. How can Harper explain what exists between her and Brendan Donegal? Harper had known Brendan when she was younger, in her 20s, and spending every spare moment on South Beach. This was before she worked for Jude. Back in Harper's first days on the vineyard, she scooped ice cream at Mad Martha's and sold tickets at the Flying Horses Carousel. On her days off, she cultivated a group of friends at South Beach, surfers and the girls who loved them. Among this group, Brendan Donegal was legend, the best surfer the vineyard had seen in 50 years. He had been sponsored by Rip Curl since he was in high school, and although he had traveled all over the world, Oahu, Maui, Tahiti, Sydney, Perth, South Africa, he always spent the month of August at home on South Beach. He drank and smoked pot at the bonfires. Everyone did. Harper lost track of Brendan for a bunch of years. They had never been close, never hooked up. Harper had been downright thrilled when Brendan had, one day, wandered into Mad Martha's, ordered a double scoop of Shark Attack ice cream, vanilla ice cream colored blue, with white chocolate chunks and raspberry swirl, a wonderfully sick joke and very, very popular, and called Harper by name. He had returned to the vineyard for good, people said, to establish a surfing school. But shortly thereafter, he had an accident. He'd been high on something stronger than weed, and he'd gone out in pre-hurricane swells. The waves were real monsters, although presumably nothing Brendan Donegal couldn't handle. But the combination of the drugs and the waves got him. People spotting thought he was gone. "He was under forever," his buddy Spider said. But then they saw his board pop up, and shortly thereafter, Brendan became visible in the washout. Spider dragged him out and performed CPR. The Edgartown Fire Department showed up seconds later and brought him back from the dead. It was a tremendous story, until it became clear that Brendan wasn't the same after that. Simple tasks eluded him. He could watch TV but couldn't read. He could ride a bike but couldn't tie his shoes. He could not surf, could not own or operate a surf school. That dream was over. Thank goodness Brendan's mother, a woman who was only ever referred to as Mrs. Donegal, was wealthy and owned a house on Chappie's East Beach that had a guest cottage where Brendan could live. He went to occupational therapy once a week in Falmouth to try to regain at least part of what he once had. After Harper got fired by Jude, she was left with nowhere to go during the day. It was autumn, and Harper had wanted to ride her mountain bike, but she feared that one of Jude's work trucks would run her off the road. She couldn't take fish to Great Rock Bite or take yoga, too public, nor could she drink all day at the wharf or the Ritz, because Joey Bowen still had friends there. And so, at that confusing and painful time in her life, Harper went to the place many vineyarders go when they want to get away, Chappaquiddick. She started out by packing up for the day with fish and heading out to Cape Pogue with her surf casting rod. But the weather soon grew too chilly, at which point Harper sought refuge at My Toy. My Toy, owned and operated by the trustees of the reservations, is a full-fledged, beautifully maintained Japanese garden, complete with a koi pond spanned by an arched wooden bridge, a stone sculpture garden, and benches well-placed for introspection, even as autumn deepens, even as snow falls in December. It had been snowing when Harper first saw Brendan there, the snowflakes light and dry, so pretty against the steel-gray sky. Harper had gone to sit on what she thought of as her bench, a long red wooden seat with a curved back that overlooks the koi pond and bridge, but someone else was sitting on it. This was the first time Harper had encountered another soul in the garden. Although it was a magical place and, she thought, transformative, it was largely ignored in the off-season. Who was this, then? Harper's first instinct was to leave. The whole point of My Toy for her was solitude. She approached, and then she saw it was Brendan Donegal. "Hey," she said. He was far less intimidating since his accident. Not an object of pity, exactly, at least not to Harper. More of an accessible god. He wore a knit cap and a Carhartt work jacket over a flannel shirt. His feet were in sturdy work boots. She wondered if he had tied the laces himself or if he'd had to ask his mother to do it. "Brendan?" Harper said. "Hi, it's Harper. Harper Frost." A slow smile spread across Brendan's face. He was still good-looking, gorgeous, really, with his light blue eyes and his sandy blonde hair kept long and shaggy. "Harper," he said. "Hi." He patted the spot on the bench next to him. She knew enough, somehow, not to bombard him with questions, and they sat in silence for a long while as the snow fell and the wind rippled the surface of the pond. Finally, Brendan turned to her. "Why do you come here?" "To get away," she said. "I made a bad decision, and I lost my job and most of my friends."
"Really?"
Brendan said.
"Me too."
When Harper went back to My Toy the next day, Brendan was there, and Harper sat with him again. The third day it was bitterly cold, and Harper nearly skipped her trip to Chappie, but it had become a ritual of sorts, so she bundled up and went. Brendan was there yet again, but after a few minutes of sitting and shivering side by side on the bench, Brendan stood up and offered Harper his hand.
"We're going," he said.
"Okay," Harper said. "Where?"
"My house," he said. "I'll make you an Irish coffee."
Harper had been hesitant because of Mrs. Donegal. Mrs. Donegal was wealthy and well-connected. Harper feared she had heard about Harper's fall from grace. She might have been friends with Jude or one of Jude's clients. It was impossible to comprehend the millions of circuitous routes that gossip traveled on the island. But it had been fine. The Irish coffee Brendan made was strong and hot, and Harper had two mugs of it. When she was finished with the second, Brendan took her mug and set it in the sink.
"I'm not the same," he said. "I'm not the same as I was."
"It's okay," Harper said. She had no idea if it was okay or what kind of scrambled messages his brain might be transmitting. "I like you the way you are now."
"You do?" he asked.
"Yes," Harper said. And he had kissed her on the cheek. They spent time together on Wednesday evenings and Sunday mornings, always meeting at My Toy, then going back to Brendan's house for Irish coffee. After a few months, Harper introduced Brendan to Fish. Dogs weren't allowed at My Toy, so Fish slept across the back seat of the Bronco in the parking lot, and it was love at first sight. Fish had cuddled up to Brendan immediately, his tail wagging as though he'd found a long-lost friend. Harper has been going over to see Brendan twice a week for nearly 3 years. Their relationship has no name. It has depth, but no breadth. Harper isn't about to suggest that she and Brendan go to dinner or grab coffee or spend a summer day on Lobsterville Beach. There is only My Toy and the coffee and a kiss on the cheek when she leaves. The Chappie Ferry is a platform barge that holds three cars and travels the 527 feet that separate Chappaquiddick from the rest of the vineyard in 90 seconds. Harper prefers the on-time 2 to the on-time 3
because her favorite fairy master, a woman in her 70s named Indira Mayhew, works on the two. Indira is as salty as they come, but after 3 years of Harper's regular Chappie visits, summer and winter, spring and fall, she knows Harper and even grants her a smile or two. "Missed you last week," Indira says. Harper feels a swell of tenderness. Perhaps Indira hasn't heard the rumors about her and Dr. Zimmer. Or maybe she has, but she doesn't connect the name Harper Frost with the brunette in the navy blue 68 Bronco. "I missed you too," Harper says. Then she feels guilty. She missed a visit for the first time ever. She will have to explain it to Brendan, or try to. A few minutes later, Harper is driving off the barge onto Chappie. Her heart is pounding. If Brendan isn't at My Toy, she will have to go to his house unannounced, which makes bumping into Mrs. Donegal, something Harper has managed to avoid up to this point, except for a few waves from afar, a valid concern. Harper pulls into the parking lot. Hers is the only car, but that doesn't mean anything. Brendan walks from home. Okay, she thinks, here goes. The gardens are another place altogether now, at the start of summer. The cherry trees are blushing pink. Their luscious blooms and fragrance are almost indecent. The ferns have unfurled, and the dell planted with camellias is in its full glory. The pond is full to brimming and nearly overflowing with fat koi. The fish swim with renewed energy, flashing the silver and tangerine of their scales. There are butterflies flitting and a concert of birdsong. Harper meanders over the newly packed dirt trail around to her spot, their spot, and she sees Brendan sitting on their bench with another woman. What? Harper thinks. She hasn't been here for a week, it's true, but she never thought she'd be replaced. As she gets closer, she sees the woman is older. It's Brendan's mother. Harper considers turning around and going back to her car, but then Brendan sees her and waves her over. There is no escaping. It's okay, Harper thinks. She can do this. Maybe Mrs. Donegal knows who she is and what she's done, but maybe she doesn't. Smile and the world smiles with you. That had been one of Billy's favorite sayings. Harper smiles. Hello, she says. Both Brendan and Mrs. Donegal stand up. My mom, Brendan says. Harper offers her hand. Mrs. Donegal, it's lovely to finally meet you. The pleasure is mine, Mrs. Donegal says, and please call me Edie. Brendan has told me so much about you. You've been such a good friend to him in a dark time. Oh, Harper says. This is the opposite of what Harper expected. She expected Mrs. Donegal, Edie, to be protective and territorial. Does Edie think that Harper and Brendan have been sleeping together? She hopes not. She doesn't want Edie to see Harper as a woman taking advantage of Brendan, but rather as what she is, someone who is attracted to the stillness of Brendan's mind and the gentle nature of his soul. I've known Brendan for nearly 20 years. We used to hang out together at South Beach. She flails for a second. She and Brendan don't talk about the days when he used to surf. She probably shouldn't bring it up now. I was happy to reconnect with him. Edie nods and offers a warm smile. You've made quite an impression. At this, Brendan springs to life. He reaches out for Harper's hand. I thought you were lost, he says. Lost to me. Harper's heart cracks. Lost to you? She says. She looks him in the eyes. His are a kaleidoscope of blue and gray. Never. Okay? Never. Okay, he says. He holds her gaze for an instant, then stares down at his feet. He's wearing flip-flops. His feet are pale. His toenails need cutting. Shall we sit? Harper asks. Would that be okay? Brendan and Edie settle on the bench, and Harper sits next to Brendan, closer than she might have if they were alone. They're still holding hands, which is also something that never happened before. My father died last week, Harper says. She looks at Edie. He was an electrician here on island, Billy Frost. I didn't know him personally, Edie says, but I knew of him. He was spoken of very highly. Thank you, Harper says. Is this true? Billy was known mostly for his Carnival Barker presence at the bar, although he also would take a service call at 9 o'clock on a Sunday night, making him popular and well-loved by his clients. Harper sighs. In addition to my father dying, my mother broke her hip, so I'm leaving tomorrow for Nantucket. She tries to catch Brendan's eye. I may be gone for a while. A week, he says. Probably longer, Harper says. She envisions being on Nantucket for a week or so, and then, once Tabitha has figured things out, she'll move on. Maybe go to Vermont or Maine. She will have to come back at some point to close on her father's house. I love Nantucket, Edie says. We rented a house on the beach at Cisco for 3 or 4 summers when Brendan was growing up. Do you remember that, Brendan? That's when you and Sophie learned to surf. On Nantucket, at Cisco Beach. Slow nod from Brendan. Edie says, we bought you a white surfboard with a green stripe down the middle. From Indian Summer, Brendan says. The owner had a dog, a Great Dane. Edie smiles at Harper. Yes. We drank mudslides at the Atlantic Cafe, Brendan says. Good, Edie says. You do remember Nantucket. Brendan turns to Harper. His eyes take on a sharp focus. Harper sees a lucidity. Come back, he says. Please. Ainsley. She is a 16-year-old left to fend for herself. Make no mistake, Tabitha is far from domestic. She and Ainsley eat takeout or go to restaurants nearly every single night, and when they do stay home, it's cereal or cheese and crackers for dinner. Tabitha never cooks, and Eleanor is even worse. She has never prepared a meal in her life. Neither does Tabitha clean. She has Philippa for that. 4 days a week, Philippa is the housekeeper at Eleanor's, but on Wednesdays, she cleans the carriage house tits to tail. She changes the sheets, does all the laundry, cleans the kitchen, including, once a month, the inside of the nearly empty refrigerator, and she dusts, vacuums, straightens, and plumps the pillows, and replaces the vases of fresh flowers. So on Wednesday, when Ainsley gets home from school, the house is clean and quiet. Ainsley's bed has been made up with fresh sheets, and all the clothes strewn across her room have been folded and put into her drawers. In Ainsley's top drawer is a bag of weed and rolling papers. Ainsley has a 10-page paper about Zora Neale Hurston due in the morning, but she can hardly be expected to worry about her schoolwork when she is dealing with family emergencies and a breakup. She rolls a joint, smokes half of it, then takes the keys to Eleanor's house off the hook in the kitchen and walks down the white shell driveway to Seamless. It's 3:30, which means Philippa will be in her room watching Grand Hotel, the Latino television series she's addicted to. Ainsley eases open the front door and tiptoes into the living room. The house smells like Lily of the Valley and Lemon Pledge. The only sound is the ticking of Eleanor's clocks. There's the grandfather clock, the grandmother clock, 2 banjo clocks, a beehive clock, and a brass carriage clock on the mantel. Every 15 minutes, these clocks provide a mini concert of chiming, which Ainsley used to find mesmerizing, but now that she comes into her grandmother's house only on surreptitious missions to steal alcohol, cigarettes, her grandmother keeps a Delft blue cup filled with individual cigarettes on the coffee table, as though it's 1955, or cash, crisp hundreds in an envelope in the secretary, the chiming nearly always gives Ainsley heart palpitations, and the ticking makes her feel like she's walking through the inside of a time bomb. One day, she assumes, she will get caught. The weed isn't helping with her paranoia. She should leave. But instead, she heads for the brass bar cart in the corner. She tucks a bottle of Grey Goose vodka under one arm and a bottle of Bombay Sapphire under the other and leaves the house, only expelling her held breath once she is scurrying back down the driveway. She makes a drink, vodka, tonic, ice, and a fat wedge of lemon. By 5 o'clock, Ainsley is drunk and really, really stoned. She polished off the second half of the joint and didn't even bother opening a window. Her mother has effectively abandoned her, so whatever behavior Ainsley exhibits is Tabitha's fault. Now Ainsley is ready to take action. At school that day, Emma had been on her like white on rice, asking if she was okay. Apparently, a rumor had been circulating through Nantucket High School that Ainsley had been locked in a closet in her house for 2 days as punishment for throwing the party. Where did people come up with this stuff? Ainsley wondered. No, she said. I was grounded Saturday and Sunday. Then my grandfather died, so on Monday we had to go to his funeral on the vineyard. Oh, Emma said. She sounded disappointed. I thought Tabitha finally went postal. I thought she might have broken out the duct tape and the rope. No, Ainsley said. My mother is annoying, but she's not psycho. My grandfather died. Emma had shrugged. That's what grandparents do, she said. They die. Ainsley had considered telling Emma about the woman who came to the reception and slapped her mother, but Emma can't be trusted with that kind of story. She either wouldn't care or would care too much. What's up with you and Teddy? Emma had asked at lunch. Did you two fight? Teddy was, for the first time ever, sitting with the baseball team at lunch instead of with Ainsley and Emma. I'll tell you later, Ainsley said. I don't feel like getting into it now. She looked across the cafeteria at Candace, who today was wearing a pink silk button-down, a pair of white AG stilts, and nude Tory Burch flats. Her mother, Steph, used to be big into braiding Candace's hair or doing half ponytails, but now Candace wore her hair straight and shiny. It pained Ainsley to admit it, but Candace was pretty. Her clothes were stylish and effortless. Her skin was clear. Her eyes radiated the pureness of her heart. Except that she had stolen Ainsley's boyfriend. Now, drunk and stoned and alone, Ainsley calls Emma. Are you ready to hear what happened? She asks. Emma isn't good at offering comfort or support, but revenge? Revenge Emma excels at. Ainsley is sitting in third period English. Her paper on Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God is 6.5 pages long instead of 10. It is poorly written, repetitive, and untethered to the text because Ainsley didn't read a single page of the book. She had tried the night before, but the dialogue is written in the southern vernacular, which might as well be a foreign language. Candace and Teddy are both in Ainsley's English class. Ainsley is sure that they have turned in 10-page papers using appropriately annotated selections from the book to back up their thesis statements and have probably also supported their arguments with quotations from Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, and Angela Davis, the way Mr. Duncombe suggested. Candace and Teddy don't speak. They don't even look at each other, but Ainsley can see the pearlescent waves of true love shimmering between them. She only has to suffer this particular hell for a few moments, however. Before Mr. Duncombe can even start in on how important the literary voices of the marginalized are, the intercom buzzes. Ainsley sucks in a breath. Ms. Kerr asks for Candace Beasley to be sent down to the office. By lunchtime, it's all over the school. A nearly full bottle of Bombay Sapphire and a baggie holding what appeared to be cocaine residue were found in Candace Beasley's locker. Wow, Maggie says as she and Ainsley move along the salad bar. I remember when Candace was a total goody-goody, don't you? Ainsley shrugs. I do, but people change. Most of the time, it's the good kids you have to watch out for, Emma says. They're so good that one day they just snap and become really, really bad. She's facing a possible 3-day suspension, Maggie says. Her parents came in and everything. 3-day suspension, Ainsley thinks. She has 3 days to get Teddy back. I'm surprised she's not facing legal action, Emma says. I mean, alcohol is one thing, but cocaine? She says it isn't hers, Maggie says. She told Dr. Benz someone must have planted it in her locker. That would be what I would say if I were her, Emma says. Wasn't me, someone planted it. She didn't ask my advice, but if she had, that would have been my suggestion. Still, how would someone else get into her locker? Ainsley says. Unless she gave someone the combination. The last person who had that locker graduated like 2 years ago, and they're impossible to break into. Impossible, Maggie says in agreement. Ainsley is both buoyed and terrified for the rest of the school day. The news about Candace is everywhere. The school is on fire with it. Candace Beasley, a straight-A student and an altar girl at St. Mary's, brought a bottle of gin and maybe also cocaine to school. It's so outlandish that Ainsley expects to be yanked out of class at any moment. But Emma has promised Ainsley that the plan was foolproof. Back in November, Emma had been tardy for school for the 5th time, which required her to meet with the principal, Dr. Benz. She was asked to wait in the room outside his office by herself until Dr. Benz returned from a Rotary Club breakfast. There was a fire drill, the school emptied out, but Emma stayed put. That was when she started snooping. She found teacher evaluations, boring, 9th grade MCAS scores, boring, and the combinations for every locker in the school. The list of combinations she kept. So infiltrating Candace's locker was easy. Ainsley was the one who had left an anonymous note for the school nurse saying there was a rumor going around that Candace Beasley had been bringing hard drugs to school and telling people it was for medicinal purposes. The school nurse, Mrs. Pineda, was fanatical about preventing student drinking and drug use. A search of Candace Beasley's locker had immediately followed. Bam. As Ainsley is leaving school, someone grabs her arm. It's Teddy. Ainsley, he says, I need you. Ainsley practically falls into his arms. She must be in love with him. How else can she explain the searing pain in her heart, the longing, the fervent desire for simple affection, a kiss on the cheek, a squeeze of the hand? Ainsley loves his blue eyes, his freckles, the way his red hair curls under his ball cap, the hollow at the base of his neck. I need you. This is what Ainsley wants to hear, right? And yet she feels insidiously guilty about what she and Emma have done to Candace. Ainsley should have won Teddy back by cleaning up her act and showing him that she can be good. But she had followed Emma down the dark path as always. They had made Candace look bad. It felt like tripping Candace up in a foot race instead of simply running faster. What's up? Ainsley asks. She decided in history class that the best tack with Teddy is to play dumb. Or if not dumb, he wouldn't believe that Ainsley hadn't heard about Candace, then at least calm and unemotional. If Candace Beasley has been caught with booze and drugs, what concern is it of Ainsley's? Can you come to the cubby? Teddy asks. Do you have time? The cubby is a secluded nook on the backside of the school building. It's shielded from the playing fields by the parked school buses and the dumpster used by the wood shop. It isn't romantic, but it is private, and couples who don't have cars frequent the cubby before school, after school, and during school. Allegra Pancik and Rick Llewellyn purportedly had sex in the cubby during morning announcements a few years earlier. The stuff of high school legend. Ainsley follows Teddy through the corridors and out the back door of the cafeteria. Jasmine Miyagi, the queen bee of the freshman class, tries to stop Ainsley. She probably wants to gossip about Candace, but Ainsley waves her off. Nobody thinks anything about seeing Ainsley and Teddy together, because nobody other than Ainsley, Teddy, Candace, and Emma know they've broken up. Teddy is 3 strides ahead of Ainsley. She had thought maybe he would walk alongside her, maybe hold her hand. They get to the cubby, find it empty. Teddy checks in all directions to make sure the coast is clear, which is standard operating procedure when using the cubby for intimate purposes. Ainsley can't wait to kiss him. But suddenly, he slams her up against the shingles of the building. Her head smacks hard. Teddy's hands are around her throat. His eyes are blue fire, and his voice drops to a scary whisper. "It was you," he says.
"No,"
she blurts. "It was you. I know it was you. And Emma, that little tart. She lifted the cocaine bag from her father's jeans pocket after he came home from work, and you stole the gin from your grandmother's bar cart." Ainsley blinks. He's exactly right. "I know you, Ainsley," Teddy says. "I know your tricks, and I know Emma's tricks. I've spent all year with you. I've waited outside while you lifted booze from your grandmother's house. I've been inside your grandmother's house. I've seen the Bombay Sapphire. The coke was probably Emma's idea. You probably resisted at first, but then she talked you into it the way she talks you into everything." Every sentence he speaks is truer than the last, but Ainsley can't give that away. She clamps her fingers, like bracelets, around his wrists.
"Get your hands off my neck," she says. "You're scaring me."
Teddy's mother is in a mental hospital. Ostensibly, her state of mind was affected by his father's death at the cat food factory. But what if mental illness runs in the family, and Teddy is not actually the greatest guy Ainsley has ever met, but rather some kind of maniac who is going to strangle her here behind the high school?
"You're scared now?" Teddy says. "Just wait."
He lets go of her neck, but she's even more intimidated.
"I'm going to Dr. Benz in the morning. That gives you time to turn yourself in this afternoon."
A part of Ainsley does want to turn herself in. She will cry to Dr. Benz, admit her wrongdoing, tell him the gin was hers but not the coke. She'll explain her broken heart, her grandfather dying, her grandmother breaking her hip, her mother leaving her alone for days. If she needs to, she will hark all the way back to losing her baby brother. She was only two, she doesn't remember him, but that doesn't mean she wasn't affected when he died. Her mother was forever changed. When Tabitha looks at Ainsley even now, she sees Julian's ghost. This may sound like a stretch, but how does Ainsley know it isn't true? Her life, she is certain, would be better if Julian had lived. Dr. Benz is famous around school for being evolved, in tune with the careening emotions of teenagers. He has a record of being lenient with students who admit their wrongdoing, but what he can't stand is a liar. To admit the truth, however, means to turn in Emma. Can Ainsley betray her best friend? No, she can't. Emma only swiped her father's empty baggie of cocaine in order to help Ainsley get back at Candace. It was Emma who took the risk of placing the incriminating evidence in Candace's locker. Someone could easily have seen her. Ainsley realizes that what she wants most, a chance at recapturing Teddy's affections, is lost to her either way. By trying to destroy Candace, she has made Candace into a heroine. So now Ainsley's choices are between bad and worse. She chooses bad. She calls Teddy's bluff.
"You sound like a hillbilly who came east and watched too much Gossip Girl," Ainsley says. "This is Nantucket. People don't plant alcohol and drugs in other people's lockers on the off chance they'll get suspended, Teddy. You can tell Mr. Benz your conspiracy theory, but it'll sound like something you saw on Netflix. I already told you. I like Candace. You two make a cute couple. I wish you only the best."
Ainsley tries to force sincerity into these last sentences, but still they feel flaccid. Teddy pauses, however. He may know her, yet she also knows him. He's unsure now.
"Fine," he says.
Ainsley has no idea what fine means. He's going to Mr. Benz, or he isn't. However, asking him to clarify seems dangerous.
"Fine," Ainsley says,
and she walks off with the manner of a girl who has nothing to fear.
Emma has already left school. And although Ainsley knows she is probably just down the street at Cumberland Farms, hanging out with BC and Maggie, smoking weed and devouring 3 slices of cardboard pepperoni, Ainsley decides to walk home. She needs to think. She never meant to be a bad kid. She only wanted to be a cool kid. When she really lets herself think about it, she can't believe what she and Emma have done. It's shameful, and it's dangerous. They're going to get caught. Of course they're going to get caught. They are going to be the ones to get suspended, or worse. And Dutch will likely get in trouble too, because the cocaine was his. Going to college might be in jeopardy. What will her mother think? What will her father think? Her stepmother Becky will be proved right. Ainsley is a bad seed, a terrible role model. She should not be allowed around her half-brothers. With each car that passes as she walks, Ainsley turns, hoping it's Emma in the Range Rover, or that it's Teddy in his uncle's truck. But all the cars are unfamiliar. The summer people are here. No one recognizes her. In the driveway of the carriage house, Ainsley sees a navy blue Bronco. She blinks. Aunt Harper's car. She came. Ainsley feels a rush of elation and relief. Aunt Harper came. But her joy is chased by a panicky fear. She told Aunt Harper that Tabitha was fine with her coming, but that was a big fat lie. Tabitha is still in Boston with Eleanor. When Harper spoke to her mother the night before, briefly because Harper was tired, meaning drunk and stoned, Tabitha said she was sending Megan over to check on Ainsley, but she had not disclosed when or whether she was coming home. Ainsley is just going to have to tell Aunt Harper the truth. Tabitha doesn't want her there. Maybe Aunt Harper won't care. Maybe Aunt Harper will stay anyway. Ainsley opens the door and is immediately greeted by a Siberian husky with eyes the color of glacial ice. A dog, Aunt Harper's dog, is in the house. Again, Ainsley is both thrilled and extremely uneasy. Ainsley has wanted a dog since the beginning of time, but Tabitha always said no. Eleanor once had a dachshund, but it ate shoes, and they had to give him away. Hello? Ainsley, is that you? Aunt Harper peers down over the stair banister. The house smells delicious, like sautéed onions and bacon. Ainsley can't remember the house ever smelling so good before. Hi, she says shyly. It's still surreal to see her mother peering down on her, only now her mother is smiling, friendly, happy to see her. Only now her mother isn't her mother. You brought the dog? You're cooking? That's fish, Harper says. Where I go, he goes. He's a very good boy. And for dinner, I'm making my famous pasta carbonara. Your grandfather loved it. And salad and garlic bread. We'll eat around 7. Is that all right? I figured that would give you a chance to do some homework. And I brewed some iced tea. It looks like you and your mom drink a lot of Coke Zero, but you know that stuff will kill you, right? Right, Ainsley says. Her stomach is now growling. When is the last time she ate? A few radishes and green beans from the salad bar at lunch, but before that? Dinner the night before had been half a bag of cheddar sun chips. She ascends the stairs to find her aunt filling a glass with ice, then tea, then squeezing a wedge of lemon into it. The drink could be on the cover of a magazine. Ainsley sucks the whole thing down, and Harper laughs. Thirsty? I walked home from school, Ainsley says. My ride cut out. Harper pours another glass of tea, then pulls out a jar of mixed nuts and a container of marinated mozzarella balls. Snack? Ainsley's eyes fill with tears. Someone is here, taking care of her. Someone loves her. Ainsley reaches for a pecan, blinking her eyes. Then she quickly wipes away the tear that falls. Harper must see it, however, because she holds open her arms. Give me a hug, she says. It's good to see you. Ainsley goes down to her room. She doesn't have any homework, but finals start in a few days.
It would be wise to buckle down, pull some good grades out of her ass to end the year. But all Ainsley can think about is Candace. Since Candace has gotten suspended, will she even be able to take finals? Ainsley checks her phone, afraid of what she might find. But there's nothing. She's tempted to call Emma and tell her what Teddy said. Maybe she can convince Emma that turning themselves in is the best course of action. Emma will never agree. They will fight. It will end badly, and Ainsley is too exhausted for another scene. She lies back on her bed. From out of nowhere, a smile crosses her face. Aunt Harper is here.